Hi, I'm Anna, and you're listening to The Climate Press.
A podcast where we aim to bring together climate science with public understanding and action.
Today on the show, we're joined by 8 different atmospheric scientists involved in the exciting Eureka Field campaign taking place in Barbados. With over 200 scientists from around the world, the project aims to advance our understanding of the interplay between clouds, convection, and circulation, along with their role in climate change. Now, we won't be the ones asking the questions today. Instead, we'll be handing over to a special host, Anna Lesbros, a 14-year-old student from France. We hope you enjoy.
Hi, my name is Anna Lesbros. I'm a French 14-year-old student. I'm doing an internship at Leeds University. The purpose of my work experience is to discover how research is carried out at the university in the United Kingdom. So may I ask you some questions about the Eurekas project?
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
So why is this field campaign necessary?
The reason for this field campaign is because at the moment, our models for predicting future climate have an uncertainty in the temperature change they predict, which is as much as 4 degrees of uncertainty. So that's a range of uncertainty for future climate at the end of this century. And the implications of that range are enormous. So at the high end, then it's complete catastrophe, maybe the human race can't survive. At the low end, it may be less of a problem. Still a problem, but less bad. We don't know where we lie in that range. And some work has been done that shows that the biggest cause, most of that uncertainty, is because the models don't capture these shallow clouds well, and they have a very big impact on the energy budget of the Earth. So we think that if we can reduce our uncertainty in these shallow clouds, then we can make a better prediction of future climate, and then we can know better, you know, what our future will hold and how we can take action to deal with the worst possible consequences.
And that was Professor Doug Parker from the University of Leeds. I'm talking now with Professor Szymon Malinowski from the University of Warsaw in Poland.
So what's your role in the Eureka project?
I am a small part of Eureka project. For years I work with clouds, and in particular I am interested in turbulence and turbulent mixing of clouds and environment. And me and my group have very fast response sensors. One of them was mounted on a British Twin Otter, with a resolution better than centimeter, to look for the temperature structure of clouds in very, very small scale.
And why is turbulence important? Why do we need to know more about turbulence?
Cloud consists of very tiny droplets. And for each droplet, it's not important what is the average properties of clouds, humidity, temperature, saturation, or whatever. For each droplet, it is important what is in its vicinity. So the droplets grow or evaporate depending on what is in its closest vicinity. So we need really very high resolution information about thermal and possibly moisture structure in clouds, moist structure of clouds. And since we do not have fast enough hygrometers to measure moisture, or humidity, we have fast thermometers, and they work as a kind of indicators of thermal structure of clouds on small scale. And this thermal structure depends on turbulent mixing of cloud with dry environment. Mm-hmm. When you see the cloud, which consists of such bubbles, you do not have a crude idea what's inside these bubbles. And if you go to very, very small scales, you can see that these bubbles are filamented, like, you know, small shells of cloud and empty space and so on. And when you fly with a thermometer through such a cloud, you have huge variations of temperature on very small differences, distances. So we have a very, very small part, which is a bit aside of the project, but which is quite important to understand cloud life.
And now we have Dr. Rafaela Vogel from LMD in Paris, France, and she's going to tell us why they chose Barbados for the field campaign.
One reason why we chose this location. But in general, the clouds are quite similar to what we would found in other comparable regions around the globe, which is very nice, because then we can assume that what we measure here is not only what we learn from the measurements here is not only applicable to Barbados or the Caribbean, but it's actually applicable to everywhere in the subtropics and the oceans, which will help us understand the bigger picture.
This is Professor Alan Blythe from the University of Leeds.
Okay, and so how is the project going so far? Have you had any problems?
Well, how's it going? It's fantastic. It's an absolutely brilliant project. It's going really, really well. There's so many ships and aircraft and ground-based measurements, kites and all kinds of things. There are measurements being made on all kinds of scales. So we're going to be able to put together a really nice story, I think. It's really is one of the best projects I've been involved in. Yes, there are always problems. There are lots and lots of small-scale problems that happen for a morning or a whole day. You solve those. Or not, so usually associated with instruments. There was an interesting problem just before I left, in that one of the aircraft is called a drone. It's a French drone, and it fell into the sea, stopped working, and fell into the sea, and they lost it. And also one of the kites, it's a big kite. Got lots of instruments on it. It broke, the tether broke, and it fell into the sea as well, and they lost that. So these kind of problems I have to deal with all the time.
Do you have any engineer or technician with you to fix your instruments?
Well, they lost those instruments because I think a big fish ate them. But yes, we have engineers on the aircraft that fix the problems. So, for example, when we got the Twin Otter, when it arrived in Barbados, it just had new wings put on, and the wiring in the wings was brand new. It had just been done. And it didn't quite work for some of the instruments, they demand a lot of detail, and they didn't work for a while. But there's a couple of guys that know exactly what they're doing. They pored over a diagram and said, "Oh, it must be this," and they fixed it. It was really good. Really impressed.
This is Dr. Arlene Lang, the director of the Caribbean Meteorological Organization.
Okay, so and how is the CMO involved in Eureka 4?
So this, first of all, I should say what the CMO is. So the Caribbean Meteorological Organization, it's basically an umbrella organization for meteorology within the Caribbean. It's weather, water, and climate, really, not just meteorology. And we coordinate joint activities among 16 English-speaking member states. And within those member states, there are national meteorological services. And so the national meteorological services are the main ones who provide daily forecasts. And then we also have what we refer to as the organs of the CMO. I'm at the headquarters unit, and I do things like ensure that there are funds available for the joint facilities, such as the radar network and the radiosonde network. Do you know what a radiosonde is? It's the balloon instrument, you know, every day, twice a day, all over the world, weather balloons are sent up, and attached to those balloons are instruments that measure pressure, temperature, relative humidity, wind, wind speed direction, and those are used to put into weather forecast models and also used just for regular forecast, even without the models. They've been used like this for all of the period of modern meteorology. And so we have within the Caribbean a number of our member states that are hosts to these weather balloon stations. And so my office basically gathers funds and disburses funds to keep those networks going. And we also have done the same thing with regard to radar, where we developed a project to put modern Doppler radars in a number of our member states. They're currently in Belize, Barbados, Guyana, Trinidad and Tobago. Those radars were procured because of a proposal that was made by my predecessors. So our office is has been doing these kinds of coordinating activities for some time. And we also have another organ, is the Caribbean Institute for Meteorology and Hydrology. And they're basically the main technical organ of the CMO. They do research, training. They are the regional climate center, the regional instrumentation center, and also a center of excellence for satellite meteorology, as well as forecasting of sand and dust. So they are, we both, as the CIMH and as the CMO headquarters, report to a ministerial level body called the Caribbean Meteorological Council. So every year we have to report to them our activities that we're doing. And so we basically are supporting and facilitating activities among the member states from our office. So that is one of the reasons why this particular activity, my job is really to bring together the forecasters from all the different member states and put together this forecasting activity that allows them to participate in Eureka.
And how will the research benefit to the Caribbean?
Oh, it will be an immense benefit, because primarily what this project is trying to understand is the clouds, the trade wind clouds, and these are very common across the Caribbean, but they have an interesting role in that they help to distribute heat in the atmosphere, and they also are very good at reflecting heat, the sunlight, back to space. So one of the big uncertainties in climate models has to do with clouds and the way that those models represent clouds. So this project is basically providing lots of good observations to help us understand how these clouds operate, how they organize, how they circulate heat, and what different types of organizations mean for how the heat is distributed and how climate might change in the future. So this project really is very, very important for helping us to do a better job with regard to weather and climate prediction. The information coming out of Eureka is also going to be used to improve the weather models as well as the climate models, and we will all benefit from that.
And now we talk with Dr. Leif Denby from the University of Leeds.
What is your typical day being like?
My typical day? My typical day is quite long. I usually wake up about just before 7, have a look at some emails, have breakfast, then I go to the ops center where I am now. So it's near the airport. We've got a number of meeting rooms and internet where all the groups can meet. I run the weather briefing, which starts at 9. And typically Caribbean forecasters will call into that and give a presentation. Then I'll record that, then I'll go to the flight meeting. Then we'll take a look at the weather forecast. And then I always have a number of jobs in the afternoon, so I'm sort of coordinating everything going on here, so making sure that everyone knows where they're meant to be. Then I do some research, try to prepare for things happening next week. Then we usually, if there's been a flight, we'll have a flight briefing, and later in the day then we'll go out for dinner, and then I do my emails from about 9 o'clock till about 1 or 2. So it's a long day. And if I'm flying, all of that is different, because if you're flying, then the day before you spend the large part of that day planning the flight, and during the day you're obviously in the air. So, you know, you go there. If we fly, say yesterday we flew at 9 o'clock, I think we set off. Forget now. You basically leave 2 hours before the departure, because you have to get to the airport, you have to talk to the pilot through, he has to check the whole plane, and you have to go off into the air. And then the flight takes 4 hours, and you come back and have to refuel for about an hour, and then you have a debrief. So then your day is very different on a flying day.
Okay.
But it's very variable. I mean, every day is quite different here. There's social activities or seminars or, yeah.
So what does it feel like to fly in a research aircraft?
It's a little nerve-wracking, but it's also very exciting, because I get to say to the pilot, I want to fly into that cloud, and unless his radar says that it's very dangerous to go into it, so if he says there's dragons in there, it would be purple on the radar, then we go into it, you know? It almost feels like you're flying yourself, because he will just direct the plane there and you go in. And the experience of we're studying the rain formation process, so the experience of the rain being different depending where you go into the cloud, all of that is it's very visceral, you know. Instead of numbers, you really use in the lower down the cloud, you see the droplets are really big because there's big splatters on the window. So it's a very close connection to the science that you're doing. The actual experience of flying is quite interesting too, because the Twin Otter is quite small. I don't know if you looked at pictures of it. It's a very compact aircraft. When we took off, it was almost like sprinting. It has such a short time it needs to go along the runway, and then it just goes. And it can turn so sharply as well. And the other thing is that we can fly really low. We can fly down to 50 feet, which is 15 meters above the sea surface, which is so close that actually the wings would almost touch if you tipped over completely. And that is just incredible. You're just really resuming along right at the ocean surface. So it's quite surreal. But at the same hand, you know that you have a scientific objective, and your time up there is limited, and you're trying to chase these clouds. And they're usually the best when you see them at a distance. You're like, oh, that one over there looks really good. But then it takes 10 minutes to get over there. So it's quite hard to sort of work out how to navigate through them to get as much out of it. So sorry, that was quite a long answer, but it's a lot of feelings.
This is Analia Albright, PhD student at LMD in Paris.
Can you tell us more about the aircrafts?
So there's five airplanes from 5 different countries. So there's the ATR from France, Halo from Germany, the WP3 from the US, the Twin Otter from the UK, and an airplane from the Barbados Regional Security Service. And I've had the chance to fly on 2 of them. I felt so lucky. It was like a really cool experience. I was on the French aircraft, the ATR, which flies pretty low in the atmosphere, like less than 1 kilometer. And it flies at the base of clouds, trying to gather data there. And then it also, it can go down to like 60 meters above the ocean, which was a little bit scary because you feel like if the plane were to turn a little bit, the wing could have like touched the ocean. And you see like the waves breaking. Yeah, we stayed there for maybe like 10 minutes. But yeah, it was very cool. And then I also had the opportunity to fly on the US plane, the P3. It's actually, there's two of them in the world, and they're designed to measure hurricanes. So they're really strong. They can withstand like strong wind speeds and strong differences in wind with altitudes, like wind, it's called wind shear. And in Barbados, they were flying at night, actually. It was from, my flight was from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. Because there's actually a lot of variability, like the cloud amount of cloud changes over the course of the day, and there's actually a lot of cloudiness at night, and so the P3 was trying to sample that, and it was timed so that it would happen during the full moon, so we nicknamed it like the werewolf flight, and it was at night because during the full moon because then that gives us the best chance of like there being enough light to actually see the clouds. And the night that I was flying, like I was surprised like how light and how clear the air was, not very polluted. It was, and I got to sit in the cockpit for a few hours. They have three pilots in the front and then two seats for visitors. And so they just let us kind of sit behind them and watch.
Ooh, that's great.
It was really cool. It felt like Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass. Yeah, and I think they got some great measurements. So I'll look forward to working with their data as well.
Well, I think you have a lot of work now analyzing all the...
Yeah.
...collected.
That's true, yeah. And then the Twin Otter, it's really like cloud chasing. It goes through the clouds and it's small, so it's pretty flexible. Halo, the German flight, flies high in circles and drops these like drop-sons. Mm-hmm. And then the Barbados airplane, we nicknamed it like the spy plane because they have a really high-tech, really high-resolution camera that's actually, it's usually surveying drug trafficking, but they were flying above, the Barbados plane was flying above the French and the British airplanes and taking these incredible high-resolution videos of the clouds, but also of the airplanes.
Wow. It
was amazing. Like we saw some of the videos and just the airplanes look so small in these clouds, which can be kilometers or even up to like 100 kilometers, some of these cloud patterns, cloud structures. So it was pretty humbling to see like we're so small, we're sampling something that is much bigger than we are. But yeah, I think also just really nice images there. And it also shows like the international collaboration that's going on in this campaign. And no one is doing something twice. Like everyone has a role, and it really fits into the bigger picture of the campaign. And it's like a really cohesive international collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing that Björn and Sondlin have and others have organized. Yeah, I think it's 11 countries, 50 institutions. So it's pretty incredible, the field campaign.
Up with Dr. Sandrine Bonny from LMD Paris as well.
And so have you made any discovery?
Something that I don't know if it's a discovery, but we were quite surprised by the fact that we found more clear sky than we thought in this area.
Mm-hmm.
When preparing the experiment, we had looked a lot at satellite observations, data from the Barbados Cloud Observatory and so on. And we had the impression that days with clear sky were very rare. And actually, when we started our first flights, we had a lot of clear sky. So maybe it was just because we were measuring things in a particular area. And so, but that was a little bit of a surprise for many of us. Otherwise, I think maybe one surprising thing is how heavy the showers can be here. So they come from shallow clouds. They can be very, very intense. That's quite amazing. We also saw that the cloud fraction at the cloud base, which is what we wanted to measure specifically for this campaign, is very variable from one day to the next, which is very nice and very interesting for us. Maybe the most surprising thing is that now that we are almost touching the end of the campaign, that we realize that we've managed to do virtually everything that we had planned to do during the campaign. That's a very nice surprise.
And did you have optimal weather conditions all along?
Yes, I think we can be quite happy with the conditions we encountered. And because we had a variety of different conditions, and that's actually what we were looking for. We wanted to take measurements in as diverse conditions as possible. But this will be important to get a robust theory or a robust understanding of the governing processes. Because if we only have one kind of situation that we measure, we might just try to find explanations for just this kind of condition. But if you have a variety of conditions, we really need to have very robust explanations which can also explain the relationship between the clouds and the environment in slightly different conditions. And I think that will make the understanding that we gain, and maybe theories that will come out of this project, will make them much more robust and representative for a variety of cases. So we had days with strong winds, with a lot of precip. So during 2 days, right after our arrival, it was kind of raining the entire time and we didn't see the sun for an entire day. But then on other days, we also had hardly any clouds. And you can imagine we have a lot of scientists which have instruments to measure clouds. And when we fly for 4.5 hours and we hardly see any clouds, of course, everyone is very disappointed in the end. So sometimes we had to then maybe go to the beach in the evening to relax and to spend some good time after having had maybe a slightly boring flight. And everyone is very excited about their measurements. So when they cannot measure anything, that's, of course, very boring. But it's just part of, as I try to say, it's part of the variability in conditions that we have. So it's also good to document a day without clouds.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting in the end to understand why sometimes we might have a day without any clouds.
Yeah, okay. So what are the most exciting things about this project?
I think for me, the most exciting is that we have so many different instruments. So you get an idea that we have a really good potential to really understand these things, because we're not just measuring it in one way. We have all these complementary things together. And I think maybe that's a sort of physicist in me, but like trying to understand how these instruments work and how they work well together and what they can tell us, I think is really cool. That's probably for me that's the most exciting thing. I mean, like I said, working with people is also really fantastic, but it's really just, you know, that as an example, the Germans brought over a construction kit for a radar. They had two container metal boxes, and out of this came pieces that we, as a group, went down and assembled a big radar, and now that's scanning out over the ocean. And so we can see all our planes fly through, and we can see exactly where the clouds are going to fly through from the radar. I just think that's fantastic, you know, being able to, it's a bit like a scout camp, you know, you go there and like you put up a tent and like you make a dining table and you have all the bits that you really need. It's the same here. We've like taken all this kit to one place and now we can do all this.
So I read that in your group in Poland,
you help to develop this temperature probe that it can take measurements of in the clouds at a rate of 1,000 measurements per second.
In fact, we record much faster. We record much faster since we recorded 20,000 measurements per second. The story is the following, that there is some interference of the thermometers, which us that very simple resistance thermometer, but they act as very small antennas. And you have many navigational systems on the aircraft, which produces a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. If you record at higher frequencies than the sensor is able to record temperature, then you can filter out all unnecessary information.
And like just, noise.
Like noise, yes. And so this is why we record much faster, even if our sensor responses, you know, real responses for about 2,000 samples per second.
Mm-hmm. Was there any weather event in the past which severity was not predicted by forecasting models that had a lot of impact?
There are always those. There. I should say that there isn't an infallible forecast. So our forecasts always have an element of uncertainty with them. One of the things that we do in our office is we collaborate with Meteo France. We actually have a formal set of working arrangements between the CMO and Meteo France that was signed in 2016. We've had many years of collaboration with them, but this was formalized in 2016. And one of the projects that we are co-chairing with Meteo France Martinique is the Severe Weather Forecast Program for the Eastern Caribbean. And what that program is trying to capture is provision of forecasts for non-tropical cyclone severe weather. So we have a very good hurricane warning system, and we have a hurricane committee that has been meeting now for 41 years. So each year the hurricane committee meets, and it's all of the countries that are affected by hurricanes in our region. So it's everywhere from Canada to Venezuela, Colombia, Panama, all of these countries and all of the islands of the Caribbean, as well as Bermuda, and we all get together for a meeting where we discuss the operational plan, ensure everybody has their backup, should they be affected by a hurricane, who will take over for their forecasting responsibility, do they have all of their instruments in place to make their balloon launches, because during a hurricane, they actually make extra balloon launches. And so we have for the hurricane warning system many years of experience. So we do not have any surprises for hurricanes. Hurricanes, the surprise has been mostly with regard to intensity. So for example, Hurricane Maria intensified very close to Dominica. So the forecast had been for a minimal hurricane, but it intensified very quickly and of course caused tremendous devastation and a number of deaths as it intensified very close to land. And that was not forecasted well. So the intensification of tropical cyclones still remains a concern, but the forecast track has been much improved through the decades. And so I would say the main surprise would be in terms of intensity, mm-hmm. not in terms of where the storm should be going so much. There's been tremendous amounts of improvement with that. For the Severe Weather Forecast Project, which is aimed at non-hurricane events. We had an event in December of 2013 that affected many islands and in which some 18 people lost their lives. It was referred to as a Christmas storm because it happened over the 24th and 25th of December 2013. And that event was one of the impetus for creating the Severe Weather Forecast Program in the Eastern Caribbean. Because there was no coordinated response to that event, and it was recognized after that there needed to be a coordinated response to an event like this, which could be just as deadly as hurricanes are, but it's happening in December. It's happening any time of year.
Is there any immediate use of the data you're collecting?
Yes, actually, in real time. So the Halo aircraft goes round in a circle and it drops sondes. So they drop a sond, what's called a sond, out the back of the aircraft. The aircraft's up at, what is it? It's really high, 32,000 feet, something like that. I think about the level that the commercial airlines fly, roughly. And so it measures a good part of the atmosphere. And people on the ground for the other aircraft, the French aircraft, it's called the ATR for short, they would like to know the best, where the what's called the lifting condensation level is, roughly where the bottom of the cloud is. So they want to know the level that they should fly at. So they want to be very close to the base of the cloud. So they can calculate these numbers from the drop sondes in real time. So that's already one use, but other people are making all kinds of use of the current weather and relative humidity measurements, satellite observations have already got some analysis going.
And so do you have other ways to communicate your work with the rest of the world?
That's also a great question. I guess the goal of scientific writing is to have it be as clear as possible, that even though there will be technical words and a bit of jargon that maybe someone who's a scientist from a different field, or someone who really doesn't have such a background in atmospheric science or physics in general, could understand the importance or how this piece of research pushes like the frontier of knowledge forward. I think that's an open question of how best to communicate science. Yeah, it's a big question. I think that's also a reason that we like to go to schools, because then you can communicate your work, really communicate the big picture. I think there's an Einstein quote, if you can't explain something to a child, you don't understand it well enough. So really grasp the essence of what you're trying to communicate by explaining it to younger students. I think it's different strategies that you write scientific papers, mostly to communicate with other scientists, but also keeping in mind the importance of outreach, visiting schools or maybe writing blog posts. We also have a blog. If you look on the Eureka website, there are different blog posts where people talk a little bit more about day in the life of someone on one of the research vessels, like one of the boats, a day in the life of someone on an airplane. And so people will be writing scientific papers about the results that come from these drop sonde measurements, but then also writing blog posts that are a little bit more accessible to a wider audience. One of the guys, one of the PhD students who's really an expert on this, his name is Geet George. He was also going to schools and he brought a drop sonde along with him so kids could really just touch it and see what is this and just have a more tactile, concrete sense of what scientific research looks like.
Okay, last question. What are the next steps for the project?
We've got a tremendous amount of data to analyze, and that's going to be our next step. We're really pushing hard to get a good quality data set from our aircraft and the ground-based measurements. It's quite tricky and quite involved, but we're going to push really hard to get something out, get a complete data set in 6 months. And it's very important to do this because there are a lot of groups that would like our data. It's the only aircraft that's making such detailed cloud microphysics data. And so people using radars and LIDARs, etc., from the other aircraft and cameras, depolarization cameras, they would like to know the details of the clouds that we're measuring. So it's very important that we get this done quickly and do a good job of quality control. So that's the next step. And of course, as well, there'll be people figuring out which models to run and how to construct the models, and hopefully start running the models. And we'll be thinking as well about, so they'll be doing that on for models on different scales, including the local cloud scale. And we'll also be thinking about the science questions, so what's come out of this and what we can address with the data that we have.
Well, I think it's really exciting to be in this group of scientists from many countries, and we have really good, you know, friendly collaborations here. And I think this experiment is great. I don't know what the outcome will be, but I hope that we will learn a lot about clouds, which will help us to better model clouds in weather and climate studies.
And would you have any tips for a high school student that wants to study meteorology or atmospheric science?
Study mathematics and physics. Yes, and look around.
Yeah.
Since the world is interesting, it's beautiful, and meteorology is about applying mathematics and physics to study your closest environment.
I can just say that I'm very happy with the way the campaign has been doing so far.
Yeah.
And again, I think the spirit, the cooperative spirit among all the partners has been really essential. And that's very encouraging for the future as well.
Okay. Merci beaucoup.
Merci à toi.
Thanks. Thanks for that. That was really nice.
On the next episode, we'll be speaking with Alexis Percival from the Yorkshire Ambulance Service and Dr. Callum Swift from Irish Doctors for the Environment about the role and responsibilities of our health systems in confronting the climate emergency.
Stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Visit our website, theclimatepress.com.
This podcast is available on Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Breaker, Overcast, SoundCloud, Pocket Casts, and Radio Public. Thank you to all the artists who contributed music to this episode. For more information, please see the website.
See you soon! And remember, make love, not CO2.